WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Americans have thought a lot about terrorism in the last few years, and my guest David Reynolds believes we can learn a few things by examining the life of a famous 19th century terrorist, abolitionist John Brown. Brown is mostly remembered for his 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry, for which he was hanged. But 3 years before that, Brown led a raid in Kansas in which his followers slaughtered five unarmed settlers as part of his crusade to rid the nation of slavery. He was a well-known figure among Eastern intellectuals of his day, some of whom helped finance his plans for a guerrilla war in the South to free slaves. Reynolds sees Brown's as a fanatic in pursuit of a just cause and believes his extremism sharpened the issue of slavery for Americans and hastened the outbreak of the Civil War. David Reynolds is a professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center and Baruch College of the City University of New York. His book is called John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. Brown became an anti-slavery activist late in his life. Before that, he was a tanner by trade who had a series of failed business ventures. He fathered 20 children in two marriages and was deeply religious. Reynolds says John Brown's views on racial equality differed from those of other abolitionists.
There were many very, very noble abolitionists of his period who hated slavery, who devoted their lives to ending slavery. However, virtually all of them retained the racist views of their era. It was an era in which blacks were considered to be innately inferior to whites. And it was surprising and a little bit sad that even Abraham Lincoln believed that blacks and whites could never live together in America. And therefore, Lincoln was a colonizationist who believed that once emancipated, blacks should be shipped out of America. And Thomas Jefferson was the same way. And so many of the abolitionists shared this racism at the same time that they loathed slavery. John Brown was very different. His parents integrated blacks into their household. They took in fugitive slaves. John Brown became very active on the Underground Railroad. And not only that, but he chose to live in North Elba, New York, which was a community of African Americans in upstate New York. Not only fraternized with them and helped them with their farming, but would quite often shock white visitors by inviting them to his table and treating them on exactly the same terms as anybody else.
John Brown is most remembered for the raid on Harper's Ferry, which ended his life. But there was this remarkable event in Kansas in 1856 known as the Pottawatomie Massacre, in which Brown essentially led in the slaughter of five unarmed settlers. Let's talk about this. What were the conditions in Kansas at the time? John Brown was there living with three sons, right?
Yes, he was there fighting slavery. What was happening was that Kansas was in a state of transition. The question was it going to become a slave state, or was it going to become a free slate, a free state? And what was happening is that it was holding state elections, but they were being largely determined by pro-slavery people from nearby Missouri who would come over in drunken hordes armed with Bowie knives and terrorize the polling booths, take over the polling booths, and elect pro-slavery legislators in Kansas. And it was a horribly corrupt situation, and John Brown and a few other abolitionists went out there to fight this. And eventually Kansas became a free state, but there was a period of transition when there was quite a lot of violence.
Right, but we're not just talking about election tampering. There were murders here, right? A lot of
them. There were murders, and some people who pointed John Brown say, oh, he was a horrible murderer. It was true that he dragged five pro-slavery citizens at midnight out of their beds and murdered them with swords. It was a horrible situation. However, that act is very rarely placed in context. We have to realize that between 1855 and 1858, three-quarters of the deaths were anti-slavery citizens, were people that opposed slavery. They were killed by pro-slavery people. And among those deaths, 28 were murdered. So in other words, there were 28 anti-slavery people murdered and only 8 pro-slavery people, 5 of whom John Brown murdered. So it's possible to say that to defend John Brown, not only on those terms, but also in the sense that he viewed slavery itself as a state of war. Slavery for him was a state of war against African Americans. That was his view of slavery.
So John Brown decides that action will be taken and vengeance will be inflicted upon the pro-slavery criminals
yes.
in Kansas. Tell us about the raid. What did he do exactly?
What happened was that there was something called the so-called Law and Order Party, which was a pro-slavery party in Kansas. And there were 5 members of this party that a couple of them had bragged, well, pretty soon we're going to wipe out all the abolitionists in Kansas. We're going to strew Kansas with their corpses. And this got to John Brown, and among the other triggers, this is another thing that made him take the action that he did. He gathered 8 people, including a couple of his own sons, and at midnight he had some swords, some broadswords. He went to the cabins of these 5 people. Actually, it was a father and 2 sons in one cabin. That was the Doyle family. Then he went on to another cabin and took out a couple of other men and murdered them.
In some cases with wives weeping and protesting, right?
Yeah. The first cabin, James Doyle, his wife, Mahala, she said, you know, I told you, James, you know, something bad was going to happen. And James Doyle said, hush, mother. And, of course, at the time, you know, John Brown came in and said, you know, I hereby arrest you in the name of the Northern Party, the anti-slavery, and, the Northern Army. And at the time, I don't think Doyle or anyone believed that he was going to be immediately executed. But he was taken outside with 2 of his sons and was murdered while the wife and the other children were inside the cabin. You know, it's a horrible kind of situation. On the other hand, so was, you know, several centuries of slavery, and so was what was happening in Kansas at the time with those 28 murders committed by pro-slavery people. There was a reason it was called Bleeding Kansas.
You know, 80 years after John Brown took the militant actions he did, Gandhi in India used a strategy of nonviolence in resisting the British. And, you know, the pacifist critique of the kind of killings that Brown and his followers undertook would be that once you commit to this kind of violence, you in effect lose some of the humanity which drove you to embrace the noble cause you were seeking to advance. And I'm wondering, how did members of John Brown's party react to the carnage that they inflicted that night?
Well, his own sons were devastated. They, you know, had some of them had mental problems after that. Some of his followers were, they said there can be no more work such as this. This is just too much for us. And John Brown himself even had ambivalent feelings about it, although ultimately he kind of reconciled himself with it. But, you know, we have to, you mentioned Gandhi and so forth. What's interesting is someone like Henry David Thoreau, who introduced the idea of civil disobedience that was used later by Gandhi and by Martin Luther King, and himself had been the greatest exponent of passive resistance in the 19th century because he was sent to jail for refusing to pay a tax to a pro-slavery government, the United States government. He was sent to jail for that, and he wrote Civil Disobedience, and this influenced Martin Luther King and Gandhi. But he became the great champion of John Brown in full knowledge of Pottawatomie and Harper's Ferry and all of John Brown's violence. Why? Because slavery at that moment it seemed to be cemented forever in place. Lincoln, before the Civil War, said, well, it'll probably take 100 years. Slavery will someday leave. People were saying 50, 80, 100 years slavery would remain. Why? Because there were a series of laws the Fugitive Slave Law, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and then the Dred Scott decision by the Supreme Court that increasingly seemed to put slavery in place for good. So it wasn't quite a Gandhi situation. This was a situation where action had to be taken. Unfortunately, violent action had to be taken to attempt to dislodge slavery.
My guest is critic and cultural historian David Reynolds. His new book is John Brown Abolitionist. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with David Reynolds. He's a critic and cultural historian. His new book is called John Brown Abolitionist. Well, David Reynolds, while John Brown was touring the East and raising money among intellectual elites, he was assembling an army in Iowa for a plan he had developed to attack an arsenal and open up a guerrilla war to liberate slaves throughout the South. He's been described as crazy, but do you think the plan actually was somewhat rational? Tell us, what exactly was the idea? What was the plan?
His idea was to raid a certain slave area, turned out to be Harper's Ferry, Virginia, a slave region, liberate slaves, and with the liberated blacks to flee into the mountains. The Appalachian Mountains ran, well, really all the way from the north deep into the south, and then scatter groups of both whites and blacks down along the mountain range, and then periodically make raids of plantations, liberate more slaves, assemble a rather large colony of blacks in the mountains, large and yet dispersed. And John Brown knew the mountains quite well because he'd been a surveyor and actually had gone into Virginia, and he knew a lot of the crags and so forth. And eventually he hoped to, through his see, the worst fear of the South was slave rebellion, slave insurrection. And he wanted to cultivate this fear, this terror. He used the word terror to make this terror grow, increase to such a degree that the South would come to want to compromise with the North on the slavery issue, to say, you know what, this is becoming unmanageable down here. You know, we're just, these slave rebellions are breaking out, and okay, we'll compromise. That was his goal. And some people have said that he was crazy. I think it was a very smart idea because if we look at modern times, at bin Laden in the mountains, there are examples, or the Afghan guerrillas against the huge Soviet army and so forth in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, you could give examples from modern times of people who have used mountainous territory to evade much, much superior forces. And John Brown said, let them try to pursue me in the mountains. Go ahead. And I think that if he had actually done what he said he was going to do, if he had managed to get away from Harper's Ferry, I mean, I don't know if he could have gotten rid of slavery like that, but certainly he could have waged a campaign of terror in the South that would have had a very disturbing effect.
So he develops this plan, which involved taking a military arsenal and armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, which is on a peninsula between two rivers, and he would have others go in the countryside and liberate slaves, and then they would have the arms and the slaves and then retreat to the mountains to build a guerrilla war. Now, it began smoothly. I mean, they took the two bridges into the armory, took the armory and took the guards hostage relatively easily. And also, his Confederates went through the countryside, liberated some slaves, brought their masters in as hostages. No. It all seemed to be going to plan. Why did it bog down?
I believe the reason it bogged down was that the reaction by the slaves was not quite what John Brown had expected. He thought that when he made his strike, the bees would hive, as he said, the bees would hive, that suddenly there would be this, the slaves would be so happy, and they would rush to his side, and then he would just, you know, take his hostages, go into the mountains, and begin his campaign of terror against slavery. What happened was a lot of the slaves were shocked. They were bewildered. They were confused. And one could say, well, why didn't, you know, obviously slaves wanted to be free. Obviously. Innately, they wanted to be. Why didn't they suddenly say, okay, let's go join John Brown? My view is that it's almost as though a Martian showed up. I mean, to them, the idea of a white person showing up at midnight and saying, you're free, a white person in the company, because John Brown had five black soldiers as well, in the company of blacks showing up and saying, you're free, it was just a completely strange and bizarre thing for these enslaved blacks. And some of them did fight with John Brown and joined him willingly. Others were just basically confused, and they had been so oppressed and so degraded for so many years that it was hard for them to suddenly identify with this person who shows up out of the blue at you know, late at night and says, you're free. So John Brown really had this kind of idealistic vision of suddenly this whole army of black warriors rushing to his side. And when that did not happen, he stalled. He delayed. He kind of kept waiting for it to happen. And it was really the delay that caused the defeat of his plans, because he waited and waited. Finally, a train went through and the news spread. And pretty soon the federal troops were there by noon the next day. The local militia was out. And he was cornered. He was trapped by that time.
So Brown and his followers were cornered in this armory.
Yes.
You know, confronted by local militia and eventually federal troops. It did not end mm-hmm. peacefully. What happened?
Well, what happened is that John Brown, as I said, stalled. The word spread. Finally, from Washington, Robert E. Lee came with federal troops. And John Brown eventually, I mean, there was a lot of violence. Several of his men were either shot down. His own son, two of his own sons died, very long, painful deaths. One was shot in the bowels and, you know, died over a course of 16 hours while right by John Brown's side. And ultimately what happened is that John Brown and a few of his remaining followers were trapped inside the fire engine house at Harper's Ferry, which later became known as John Brown's Fort. And Robert E. Lee sent some troops that battered down the doors of the fort and came in, killed a couple of people. And one person, one soldier, made several thrusts at John Brown with his sword, and John Brown should have died then because he was stabbed in the stomach and he was stabbed in the head several times. But the person who stabbed him had accidentally picked up his dress saber, his dress sword, which is like a sort of a phony sword, and kept on stabbing John Brown, but instead of his military saber. Military saber would have just instantly killed John Brown. But just in the rush that morning, he picked up his dress sword. And as a result, John Brown lived. And that's the only reason why John Brown had effect on American history, because what happened is that he lived and he talked, and the nation watched him talk and act nobly during his imprisonment.
You conclude that John Brown's raid had enormous impact on slavery, really because of the way John Brown behaved during it and after it at his trial.
Yes.
And the way those events were perceived. I mean, how was John Brown remembered or even mythologized, you know, by both sides in the conflict over slavery after the raid?
Because he lived, the legend of John Brown grew. And the reason it grew is the way he behaved during his imprisonment and trial. Some of his backers in the North went crazy. One was overwhelmed with guilt and ended up in a lunatic asylum and so forth. And others fled the country. But John Brown himself remained very strong and throughout his entire trial. And at the very end, he made a statement of less than 250 words that Emerson said was as great as the Gettysburg Address. It was just a statement of his anti-slavery views. And as a result, he slowly gained favor in the North. At first, virtually all the Northerners said, who is this strange guy who attacked the South? They basically, they kind of admired his anti-slavery views, but they really dissociated themselves from him. But then Thoreau and Emerson and a few others said, now, wait a minute here. This guy is – Thoreau and Emerson put him virtually on the same level of Jesus Christ very literally, because Emerson said, John Brown will make the gallows as glorious as the cross. And this statement by Emerson, who had a lot of cultural clout, shot throughout America like a ricocheting bullet, and it polarized the country. And the South, which had formerly praised John Brown's character, of course, as I said, they always hated him, but they praised his character, suddenly demonized him. And suddenly John Brown was not only evil, but also representative of basically what was going on in the North. And so suddenly John Brown became an incredibly polarizing figure, a symbol, something much larger than, let's say, Ruby Ridge or Oklahoma City have become in modern times. He became a huge, tremendous symbol for both the North and for the South.
Well, David Reynolds, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
David Reynolds is a professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center and Baruch College of the City University of New York. His new book is John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.